Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. North and South Carolina are among the most vulnerable places in the country when it comes to experiencing the impact of climate change. Some would say that we are in the eye of the storm. We're already feeling some of the effects of rising sea levels and of more frequent, more intense storms. And despite those who may say otherwise, humans are contributing to the problem. We speak with some experts in our region about why the Carolinas are in the bullseye of this impending storm, what it means for those of us who live here, what has been and is being done to mitigate some of the effects, and where the gaps remain. And we examine our other environmental concerns across our two states as well. We're joined by Ron Rejesus, professor and extension specialist in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at North Carolina State University. Faith Rivers James is executive director of the Coastal Conservation League, which works to protect the health of natural resources in the South Carolina coastal plain. Dana Smith is founder and executive director of the Dogwood Alliance, whose mission is to protect southern forests and communities as the best solution to to climate change. And Bobby Jones is president of the Down East Coal Ash Environmental and Social Justice Coalition, which is dedicated to protecting the environment and advocating for those most affected by toxic environmental conditions, most frequently black, brown, and poor white communities in eastern North Carolina. Thank you all for being here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We've done a lot of programs on climate change, which tend to center on carbon emissions and the impact of vehicles and things like that, all of which is true. But we're going to bring some different perspectives to this conversation that we really haven't talked about before, like the impact of deforestation and using the wood from those trees as fuel, rising sea levels and the impact of certain kinds of farming on the climate, which we've never talked about how the byproducts and activities that we've engaged in for a century or more have played into climate change as well. So, Rod, I'm going to start with you because your main interests deal with how climate change relates to agriculture. We all have to eat. The safety and sustainability of our food supply should be at the top of our list of concerns. What are the challenges to agriculture that you're already seeing as a result of climate change here in the Carolinas?
So, as you said, agriculture, food is important, and agriculture in and of itself is one of the most vulnerable to climate change and impacts of extreme weather and the magnitudes of extreme weather. Hurricane Florence, that was discussed earlier, impacted the agricultural sector in North Carolina and South Carolina, and we have been seeing already sort of losses and damages, not just here, for the whole U.S., in the Midwest even, with rising temperatures. And it's it's not only the yields, it's also the variability. So the incomes of farmers as well, and the variability of what they're getting is becoming more variable over time.
You've really taken a hard look at the Midwest. I know that's one of the areas that you've studied. What are you seeing, and is it getting worse in just a short amount of time? How's it working?
Yes, so it's more of a slow rise of that variability. But you could see now, over the last decade or so, even with newer technologies that our agricultural sector is using, the variability of those yields for corn, soybean, these kinds of crops has been increasing. So even with technological innovation, there still needs to be done in terms of helping our agricultural sector in terms of risk mitigation and mitigating the impacts of climate change if we want to have a sustainable food sector going forward.
Well, I was going to ask you how what you're seeing in the Carolinas in relation to what you've witnessed and studied in the Midwest, how similar or dissimilar it may be. But I know that in Georgia, they were talking last year, Georgia peach growers, about not being able to grow peaches much longer there because they don't have a cold enough winter anymore, and those trees require cold weather.
Right. So, I mean, those temperature rises have impacted the ability to plant. Here in the Carolinas, of course, the coastal area is an important area as well. So with coastal flooding, sea level rise, they have to deal with that issue as well. One of the things that perhaps not a lot of people know is that sea level rise results in salt water intrusion for agricultural farms. So our farms on the coast is also affected by that, compared to, say, in the Midwest, there is no coast, right, where they don't face that kind of problem. So not only do we in the Carolinas face sort of lower production, perhaps, due to climate change, but people eventually abandoning farmland because we can't do it, given the sea level rise.
Farmers are certainly paying attention to this. You, as an academic, are paying attention to this. Are policymakers paying attention to this?
Good question. There are sort of, with the current administration, there was the, what they call the Inflation Reduction Act that passed. And there are sort of monies that came with that to help with sort of mitigation and conservation practices to sort of help mitigate the effect of sea level rise and salt water intrusion. But given the discussion earlier in the first panel, it's information, education, access to these kinds of programs are important. And I think that's where sort of WFAE and media sources and these kinds of summits are important, because some of our farmers in the agricultural sector, especially the smaller farmers, are not aware. How do I access this fund for climate change mitigation?
We're going to hopscotch through a lot of different topics and areas of expertise, and Dana Smith is here. She is the founder and executive director of the Dogwood Alliance, which deals with deforestation. When we think of deforestation and climate change, I always think about the Amazon and what's going on down there and its impact on the world's climate. But it's happening here, too. To what degree?
Absolutely. Well, the South is the world's largest wood-producing region.
I had no idea. Did you know that? No. Okay.
And even more shocking is that it's been estimated that the rate and scale of industrial logging is four times that of South American rainforest. And I'm just going to say that one more time so everybody hears it. The rate and scale of logging in the southeastern U.S. is four times that of South American rainforest. And the impacts that this is having on communities and on climate change often go unrecognized. Logging is the leading cause of forest carbon loss from our forests. It's not development, it's not conversion to agriculture, it's not tree mortality from wind storms and hurricanes. It's industrial logging by a magnitude of about six times all of those other drivers of forest cover loss combined. So it's a huge issue that we in the Southeast need to start grappling with. The impacts are borne disproportionately by rural communities in the coastal plain of the South, which also tend to be the communities in our region that are highest poverty, highest indicators of socioeconomic stress, highest populations of indigenous and black communities. So it's a huge environmental justice issue. Forests are such a critical part of the solution to climate change. When left standing, they can pull massive amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere, and that will help cool the planet down. They also, when left standing, provide optimum natural flood control. They're also natural air conditioners. Mm. There is nothing more important in terms of a tool that we have to both solve the climate crisis and become more resilient through a changing climate than protecting our forests.
You mentioned the social justice aspect of that, of this, and the fact that this logging is taking place in areas that are populated by indigenous people, low-income individuals, black individuals, etc. How does the fact that this logging is taking place in those locations impact their lives?
So a lot of the communities that we work with talk about many ways that this industry is disrupting their quality of life. They've noticed that the logging is, that the flooding, for example, is worse where the logging is occurring. You know, they see this, they live on the ground. Communities are our best data sources on some level for the impacts that, you know, are being inflicted in their communities. They talk about the logging trucks and the pollution and the noise that happens from, you know, the logging trucks and how they're tearing up the roads. They talk about the lack of economic opportunity in their communities and wonder why communities where there's large swaths of public lands or opportunities for outdoor recreation, those communities tend to be better off from an economic standpoint than those that are dependent on industrial logging. So they're questioning why their community is being targeted, if you will, for industrial extraction, as opposed to their community being able to experience an economy that is both more diverse, more thriving, and more healthy for their communities. Outdoor recreation creates way more jobs than the forest industry does in both South and North Carolina. And yet in a lot of these communities, the land is privately owned, so there's, and it's in commercial production. So the opportunity to develop outdoor recreation economies is severely restricted. In fact, some of these communities are what we call recreation deserts. They're surrounded by forests, but they're all privately owned. They're in commercial production. And so communities are really starting to question the benefits of the forestry industry and starting to look to ways that they can start to seed an economy in their communities that is grounded in forest protection.
You mentioned earlier all of the benefits that having trees does for the climate and for the environment and the damage done when you cut them down. The one thing you didn't mention, which I never even thought about, was burning the wood that comes from logging these trees. And in many cases, these trees are turned into wood pellets, many of which are shipped to Europe, and they burn them as fuel. Which contributes most to climate change, the loss of the trees or the burning of the trees?
I think the burning of the trees is probably the worst thing that we can do in terms of, you know, you can't separate the logging and the impacts of the loss of carbon from then the carbon in the forest being burned to generate electricity. And scientists are documenting that this is worse than coal. At the smokestack creates, you know, 50% plus more carbon is being emitted than is being emitted by burning coal when you burn wood pellets. And the South has just recently become, in the last decade, the world's largest exporter of wood pellets, where they're burning them at power stations in Europe. So it's not even energy that we're using here. But the impacts of logging extend beyond the biomass industry. The impacts of logging also include the paper industry, the wood products industry. You know, when forests are left standing, they're storing carbon. When they are cut down, that carbon is eventually going to be released into the atmosphere. Even when you're developing a wood product that's solid, a 2x4, or for building materials, there's still a net loss of carbon because there was more carbon in that forest before the forest was cut down, and only a fraction of the wood that ends up in a building, that's only a fraction of that carbon from the forest actually ends up stored in a wood product.
That's Dana Smith from Dogwood Alliance. More from WFAE's Climate Summit coming up. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. We're back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE, and we're listening to our conversation from the WFAE Carolinas Climate Summit. We continue our discussion on climate change in the Carolinas with our panel, Bobby Jones from the Down East Coal Ash Environmental and Social Justice Coalition, Dana Smith of Dogwood Alliance, Faith Rivers James from the Coastal Conservation League, and Rod Rejesus, professor at North Carolina State University. There have been, over the years, a lot of climate change deniers, and perhaps the canary in the coal mine for anybody with vision would be the coastal areas, because that's where it began to show up undeniably. You have sunny day flooding going on there. You have worse storms, which are deluges of rain in those areas. You have beach erosion, which has always been a problem. Saltwater intrusion, which is something Rod talked about. And then there's the idea of growth in those areas, which is exacerbating the problem. Faith Rivers James is the executive director of the South Carolina Coastal Conservation League. How many of those are contributing to climate change, or are the direct causes of climate change, or is it inextricably intertwined?
It is all of the above. In South Carolina, of course, we are dedicated to preserving our coastal plain, protecting the habitat and wildlife that are there, and empowering our communities to protect themselves, to preserve themselves in the face of rapacious growth and development. And so when we look at climate, we're looking at Charleston Harbor going up an inch per decade. We have had 27 flooding events in the past year, the highest on record. Six of those were considered major flood events. And so we are contending with the water. We are the fifth most likely to be hit by major storms. And this is our 35th year of the Coastal Conservation League. The year it was founded was the year that Hurricane Hugo came through Charleston. And we are now at the center of another storm that is coming our way, and it is dealing with the effects of climate and all the storms and all the rain and the tidal flooding that comes with it.
And I know that you live and work and concentrate on South Carolina, but can we say that the same things are impacting North Carolina?
Oh, very much so. North and South Carolina share having a lot of the marshland and wetlands that are left. South Carolina has over 350 acres of wetlands, of marshland, the highest in the nation. And it is important for us to consider that as sea levels rise, marshes suffocate and drown. And so if we don't do something to preserve those marshes, our sponge that helps us contend with flooding will go away.
You also say that people have to, in the coastal areas, have to learn to live with water, which sounds like an oxymoron, because you're there for the water, but you're talking about intrusion, water in places it should not and has not been in the past. Is that correct?
Correct. When we are talking about learning to live with water, it is how do we contend with flooding events? Frankly, in my family, we're now getting a tidal clock so that we can be aware of when high tides and sunny day flooding are going to affect us. As a business, we have to decide when we bring our workers downtown when the crosstown's going to be flooded in downtown Charleston. And so when we say we learn to live with water, we also have to learn to moderate our actions so that we are not putting more people in harm's way when we are contending with that development.
A couple of years ago, because we did a program on this, the city of Charleston was considering restrictions on fill and build, which I guess is a way to control growth. Within their 100-year flood zone, did they enact those? And if so, has it had an impact?
Well, I'm proud to say that we worked with the city. We adopted an ordinance that would stop the fill and build in those flood-prone areas. So it will take some time. This just happened in the past year. It will take some time to see the effects. But we are always on the defense with regard to fill and build. Because when you're talking about building inside the wetland areas, that is the challenge. We don't want to see a lot of wetlands filled because it has an impact on the rest of the city. When you're going to place homes inside of those wetland areas, you're filling it, you're basically reducing our ability to absorb water. But we also have to contend with planned unit development rights that have been granted sometimes a decade ago, before we were contending with all of these impacts of climate. And so conditions on the ground are changing, even though development rights have already been granted.
Let me go back to something you said really early on, and that was that the water in Charleston Harbor is rising an inch a year.
An inch per decade.
Per decade, excuse me. Yes. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it must be, because that's why you referenced it. Explain what the impact of that is.
Well, of course, you know, downtown Charleston, there is a battery, and that the tip of that peninsula is a hardened structure. It was built to contend with the level of water decades ago. And so every time you add an inch, that's more flooding. And you contend with more of the rain coming down from the major storms. And so that rain, combined with storm surge or event surge, not necessarily hurricane, but any kind of major storm, those things added together are resulting in sunny day flooding. Bright sunshine outside, but you can't get down to the Citadel where I used to work because there's water on the roads. Mm.
Bobby Jones is with us. He's president of something we haven't talked about yet, and it's kind of an after effect of things we've talked about in the past with regard to burning things to produce electricity, and that is coal ash. He's the president of the Down East Coal Ash Environmental and Social Justice Coalition. And this is something kind of a different impact that this is having. We've been burning coal since the early 50s and turning it into coal ash in many parts of the Carolinas in order to generate electricity. That's slowly transitioning, so we're not producing as much, but we still have the storage problem of coal ash in these pits, and sometimes the pits are covered, sometimes they're not. It threatens the groundwater supplies in some areas. You're particularly concerned with how coal ash has been stored and who suffers as a result. Who is most affected and how?
I'm not only concerned about how it's stored, I'm concerned about the fact that it has been burned since the 1950s, all over our state. Duke Energy has been burning this, and in my community, they switched over from coal to methane in 2012, and they continue to burn methane. In addition, within the last few years, they started reburning the already poisonous coal ash, calling it recycling, as a means to get rid of the coal ash. Now, in my community, we got 6 million tons of coal ash, and these so-called recycling plants, we can only burn 200,000 pounds per year. So you know about how long it's gonna take. I want to be there when they complete the last amount. But clearly, the communities that's most impacted are the BIPOC and poor communities. They're the ones that's relegated to live in these environments. They're the ones that can't afford to live elsewhere. They're the ones that, when it starts raining, their homes are flooded, and they're the ones that have to be relocated. You know, they're the one that's homeless. You know, we have people that lost their homes from Matthew in 2016, and just received temporary housing within the last couple of years. I'm concerned about the carbon plan and how somehow Duke Energy has been empowered by the North Carolina Utility Commission, because they clearly have not demonstrated that they don't have my trust, that they're going to protect my community or protect the other people in the state of North Carolina when it comes to protecting us from fossil fuels.
But last year, the EPA announced protections for communities who had been damaged or might be damaged from coal ash contamination and would hold polluters accountable for that damage. Has it started to take effect? Does it work? Is it enough?
What I usually carry around with me, I carry around a picture of three of my friends. Of that picture, two of those individuals are dead, and both of them were a lot younger than I am. And of that third picture, she's alive, but she's the husband of another friend of mine who just recently died. All of them died of cancer. All of them lived within this coal ash community. There's a lot of people that has cancer and has died and continue to die from cancer. There have been no acceptance of responsibility by Duke Energy, but they did pay for these people to have water for 3 years, and they've also reached a settlement. One of my struggles and one of the tenets of my agency is to make sure that impacted community members, frontline community members, are afforded the opportunity to articulate their concern and have some input in what's going to happen to them. There are too many decisions that's being made by people that all they've done is have driven through a polluted community. My concern is this: if you got to live with it and die with it, because certainly so many of my community members have died, then you need to have not only a seat at the table, an opportunity to articulate your concerns and your resentment. If you have to deal with a bad consequence, at least you had an opportunity to express your truths.
And coal ash is only one of your areas of concern. Another one are these concentrated animal feeding operations that result in these lagoons of pig waste, which I'm told, reading material from you, that it's not just waste now. It's they're throwing animal parts and sometimes whole animals into these lagoons. Sometimes they cover them, and it gets so bad that the covers, the thing explodes. It contaminates the groundwater. It contaminates the air around us. Once again, the same people affected by this, correct?
Absolutely. And instead of dealing with the hog waste and like to have the ponds, they call them lagoons. Imagine that. They just put a thin plastic cover on them, siphon the methane off of it, and treat it and sell it so they can burn it and to generate electricity. That's the trend now in the CAFO industry. However, some people get overzealous, and we had a situation in my county, Wayne County, where they were Smithfield were bringing their old meats and they would throw them into to the digester, and they got to the point they were throwing in whole carcasses, and it just started fueling, and it literally exploded and just brewed 38,000 gallons of waste into our ecosystem. It is a concern. Some Department of Environment Quality have not addressed it, cumulative impact. They don't want to address that. They don't want to address legacy pollution. And they really need to be addressed if we're concerned about a path forward.
Dana.
I was just going to say, you know, this is one of the issues we've been dealing with the expansion of the wood pellet industry, is they're coming in on top of, you know, the hog farms, the chicken plants, the, you know, other polluting facilities in these same communities. And the wood pellet industry is, you know, highly polluting as well. It's not just the deforestation, the loss of forests, the clear cutting, the conversion of natural forests to pine plantations, but it's also the volatile organic compounds that are released from the smokestacks during the processing of these facilities. So the cumulative impacts is a huge issue. You're talking about industry on top of industry on top of industry in these same communities. And there has to be some grappling with, you know, the impacts that this type of extractive industrial scale economy is having disproportionately on certain communities that are black and brown.
And in fact, you call those sacrifice zones.
Absolutely.
Is that intentional? Is that just an unintentional consequence of allowing these things to happen? Because we need to feed each other. I mean, industrial farming is necessary. Electricity production is necessary. If you use the wood to produce electricity, some would argue that's necessary. We have a lot of people in the world that have to be clothed, fed, housed, and heated.
Well, there's a way to do that. You know, I think this is very intentional. You know, take it to your neighborhood. You know, don't bring it to mine, if you hear what I'm saying. I mean, if we're going to go there. But I think there need to be ownership for everyone and proactively planning. And we don't have to do that like that.
And Faith, in these situations where these things that are happening to clothe, feed, house, and keep the power on, is it kind of trickle down? Because it's the coastal areas who are feeling this first, I guess. And it's you're paying the price for all of the things that we're benefiting from. Would that be accurate?
Well, I do think it is important to note that deciding what happens in your community through land use planning, that gives us an opportunity. Land use planning is democracy at its best and at its worst. And one thing we focus on at the Conservation League is empowering folks to go and show up and speak for themselves, to understand how the process works, to train them on how to advocate. We help our members and friends and supporters articulate their concerns about what's coming into their communities. And then also to make sure that things are monitored as they're there. So I think it is important to understand when land use in and of itself, as a property professor, I would say, land use is a decision about what goes where. And they are making decisions about where those bad uses go. And so if we collectively want to change how those decisions are made, we need to advocate with people in our communities to, you know, show up, to speak up, and to try to make change and say we don't want those kinds of things coming into our communities.
Rod, some of the things we were talking to Bobby about, the pig farms, et cetera, and even the deforestation in areas that, you know, all of that affects farming. And we've talked about climate change and farming. But when we talk about farming, we're not talking necessarily always about ma and pa farmers. We're talking about big agriculture here that the farmers work for, and sometimes they work for them on a subsistence level, quite honestly. Is big ag concerned about these things?
They would say yes, right? But again, this is sort of the question of balance, and accountability needs to be there as well. So I understand what Bobby is saying and what Faith is saying on the consequences of these things. And so some sort of cooperative agreements and cooperative planning is needed. Also, from an academic side, right, technological innovations perhaps would help. And so NC State, as a land-grant university, plays a role in terms of, okay, are there other ways to make the wood pellet industry, the hog industry, more environmentally friendly? How do I stop the exploding lagoons? Those kinds of things. So, and that's, I think, where the public institutions and educational institutions and the research and the extension that NC State is doing might play a role in terms of helping. Again, as you said, you have to feed, you have to clothe us, and electricity is there, right, as well. And so is there a balance? Is there some innovation that we could use, and universities and public institutions like NC State will play a role?
That's Rod Rahesus from NC State University's Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics. We have more from our panel from WFAE's Carolina's Climate Summit in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks. We're back for the final segment of the conversation we had last week at the WFAE Carolinas Climate Summit with Dana Smith from Dogwood Alliance, Faith Rivers-James from the Coastal Conservation League, Rod Rahesus from NC State, and Bobby Jones from Down East Coal Ash Environmental and Social Justice Coalition.
Bobby, you just said a few minutes ago that you don't necessarily trust what you're being told. And you're not the first person I've had on this program who has said that. But last year, Governor Roy Cooper signed an executive order which said, he said, would outlast his administration, which is advances environmental justice for the state, something Cooper says will take a, quote, whole of government approach. Has it borne fruit?
Nobody told me this is going to be the hot seat over
here. Welcome.
Let me back out and come in again. We have got to do better. We're on a planet that's pretty sick right about now, and we've got to gather ways of problem solving any way that we can. And I'd like to think that God, in His infinite wisdom, provided us with a horrible thing like COVID-19 in order to show us what we're capable to do as a society, as a world. We discovered that if we stop driving these automobiles, Mother Earth will kind of heal itself. Another thing we discovered, while the tractor and trailers hauling produce from California and the Midwest to North Carolina, we discovered that local farmers could produce natural, fresh fruit, produce, vegetables that they couldn't even get here. What I'm saying is that we've got to take a different approach. As a country, we are just so grounded in extraction. You know, I guess it's profitable, but we've got to look at our extractive nature.
Explain extractive farming, because that's one of the things that you talk about in some of your writing. What is extractive farming?
It's when you don't farm in a sustainable fashion. You're so focused on production and profit that you just literally rob the soil of everything that it has. You don't engage in rotation of crops. You don't engage in, you know, ground cover to support carbon sequestration. You don't support healthy farming. Extraction is a word that BIPOC communities understand real well, because it's had historically happened to us in our communities.
And on the other side, the flip side of that extractive farming coin, there has been a push toward what is called regenerative agriculture, which focuses on improving the health of the soil and using techniques that don't harm the climate, which also improve farmers' incomes. This is not only important in terms of environmental impact, but also in quelling concerns that unless we embrace these practices, I read yesterday, within 50 years, there may not be enough good soil to feed the world. Is this more of a climate change issue or just a sustainable life on Earth issue?
Well, I think it's the latter. It's the sustainable life on Earth, and it goes back to what Bobby's saying in terms of, okay, are we moving from extractive to more regenerative? That's where we want to sort of perhaps go. In fact, carbon sequestration, cover crops, these kinds of things are being studied and are being sort of looked at in particular to move from that extractive to a more regenerative and sustainable agriculture. But on the flip side, playing devil's advocate here, it's like farmers also need sort of, I'm an economist, so the bottom line needs to be there. But the last thing you said, that, well, it could be profitable as well. Sometimes folks don't see that. And it also, there's a time dimension. It's not instant that if you use, you know, carbon sequestration practices now that you'll see the bottom line dollar effect right now, but over time, that's what people have seen, that yes, it could be profitable, it could work together such that it's not extractive, it's regenerative.
But the bottom line is the bottom line, and farming is a business. So if the payoff is 40 years down the road, how difficult is it to get buy-in to do some of the things that we need to do for the climate, for the health of the soil, et cetera?
That's where the public policy and sort of government programs play in. And that's where access to programs that help encourage, subsidize, educate folks about these regenerative practices play a major role.
And Faith, am I right that your organization works with policymakers and with farmers and businesses to support sustainable agriculture? Am I just making that up?
No, that's correct.
Okay.
We started the first food hub in South Carolina. And our goal here has multiple facets. But our vision is to help keep our farmers engaged in farming in our rural communities across the coastal region. One, that helps us ward off rapacious development, because every farm that's there is not a Walmart. But two, when we produce local food, we reduce some of the carbon impacts of trucking in our food from other places. And so our organization, we have a couple people that work with our farmers about the types of crops and rotating the crops, picking things that will be able to help them deal with saltwater intrusion so that they can come up with a product. And our mission is to bring that product to the markets, to restaurants in Charleston, so that, you know, in our restaurant scene downtown, you can come in and you can have vegetables that were produced at the Gullah Geechee Co-op on St. Helena Island. Mm. So it is to preserve the community, to preserve our rural landscapes, and to help decrease our carbon footprint by producing our food locally.
And some of the food we eat is actually seafood, and saltwater intrusion is actually a problem for that, because the oyster beds and other kinds of seafood that we eat are changed, or they die off because of this saltwater intrusion. How concerning is that problem to you right now? How concerning is saltwater intrusion, Rod, to farmers who farm the land right now in North and South Carolina?
Yeah, it is a big problem along the coast. So it causes, of course, if there's saltwater intrusion, the yields and the ability to produce is impacted negatively, in essence. And one option, of course, is, well, I'll just change the crop that I'm a more salt-tolerant crop, like asparagus. But you can't perhaps make the same amount of money with asparagus compared to the others. And so a lot of research right now actually at NC State is looking at varieties that will tolerate some of these things to help them to be more resilient in terms of being more resilient to the salt water that comes into their land. Mm.
This year, Dana, the governor of North Carolina released another executive order that aims to protect wetlands by conserving 1 million new trees and to restore and reforest another 1 million acres. How much of an impact is that likely to have if it's successful?
Well, I think we commend Governor Cooper for recognizing the importance of wetland forests in the coastal plain of North Carolina and in the Carolinas more generally. Wetland forests are so vital for natural flood control, for carbon storage, for, you know, all the things we talked about earlier. And so it's encouraging to have the governor actually publicly recognize the importance of protecting and restoring wetland forests. The issue is going to be whether or not, you know, that executive order actually ends up protecting forests from industrial logging or just protecting forests from development. We all know we need to protect forests from development. We also need to protect forests from industrial logging. And so we're hoping that that executive order will in fact be used to permanently protect forests from industrial logging and keep forests standing, and that a big target of that area will be, in fact, those communities that are experiencing the worst industrial logging impacts from the expansion of the wood pellet industry, which happened under Governor Cooper's watch. So there's that. There is, the 1 million acres is not enough. It's not going to be enough. We need widespread, large-scale forest protection happening. And to do that, we need a whole suite of new policies that encourage more regenerative economic practices, both in the forest industry, but also transitioning away from forest-dependent communities, forest industry-dependent communities, to better economic development opportunities like outdoor recreation. We need more investment in communities in terms of land that is publicly owned. We need incentives for landowners to keep their trees standing. There's lots of tax breaks for landowners who log their forests and who convert their forests from natural forest to plantations. We need a suite of policies that move us in the other direction that are really about trying to keep as much forest standing as possible. And we need to stop subsidizing the industries that are destroying forests. So first case in point, the wood pellet industry. Right now, the biggest wood pellet manufacturer in North Carolina just filed for bankruptcy. And we have bankrolled them from taxpayer dollars to the tune of millions of dollars already. And they are applying for more subsidies under the IRA at the federal level. And we're working really hard right now to try to stop subsidies under the IRA from bankrolling more expansion of the wood pellet and biomass industry. So that's also another key part of this. It's not just about seeding the things that are going to help move us in the right direction, but it's also about cutting the things that are continuing to perpetuate the same harms and the same climate impacts that we've been seeing over the past decade.
I want to end this conversation by going down the row here and have each of you address how optimistic or pessimistic you are in your individual areas of concern about the future and fixing some of the problems that you see. And I'll start with Rod Jesus from NC State.
I'm an optimist at heart, so I'm more positive in being in an educational institution that we have the ability to sort of solve these problems. And moving forward, if there's continued support and education among the people and developing innovations for addressing all these problems, we could do it.
Faith Rivers James.
Well, my name is Faith, and so I have to be optimistic. But I am confident that when we work with people in communities, we empower them, we inform them about the choices that they have, that they can and will stand up to protect their own neighborhoods and areas. And so I think we all come to these spaces because we love them, or we stay in these places because it's in our hearts and souls, and we'll do anything we can to protect it. So I'm very optimistic.
And your middle name is Rivers, so you have to be. You're connected to the coast.
And I live
there.
On a river.
Exactly right. The South Carolina Coastal Conservation League. Dana Smith is with the Dogwood Alliance. She's very concerned about deforestation. Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I'm worried about where we are right now and the magnitude of how much we need to transition in order to get through. But I am optimistic. I have been fortunate enough to work with a number of folks from the civil rights movement who have reminded me that it felt like there was never gonna be any progress until there was. And I think we're in the middle of a revolution right now. We're in the middle of massive change in our society. And I believe very strongly that if we can start to recognize the important role that nature plays in our ability to survive, if we can shift our culture away from one that just sees nature as a commodity to be bought and sold for profit, and we start to transition our relationship with nature and with each other, and we can make that cultural shift, I believe that we can get through. And I see that happening in different places all across this region. And so that gives me hope. Those pockets of communities that are on the front lines hold this incredible space for both the pain of what they've experienced, but also the joy of their community and their faith in our ability to get through. Connecting with those frontline communities, that has really given me the most hope that I have right now in my work.
And Bobby, I'm going to put you back, Bobby Jones, in the hot seat again and ask you the same question, optimistic or pessimistic, but because you are the president of the Down East Coal Ash Environmental and Social Justice Coalition, are people beginning to recognize the impact of climate change and the causes of climate change as a social justice issue? And if so, will that move the needle more quickly, do you think?
I begin to realize that, you know, this is climate change. We're in the throes of it. And now what do we do? And don't get me wrong, there's still a pretty large sector of people who are still in the extractive mode. You know, while I've seen so much that I should probably be one of the most negative persons that you know, I've seen so much resilience, so much strength, and people, in particular frontline community people, that I have no choice than to be optimistic. One of the things that we're committed to Down East is that be supportive of where we think the some of the answers to our problems lies, and that's by ensuring that frontline community members have a chance to articulate and help drive whatever solution that we're gonna have. If we're having a meeting and if somebody that's not from that community is a part of that meeting and representative for that community, when that meeting is over, everybody go to their respective places. But the impacted community member goes back to that poison, goes back to the funk of the hog farm. If they've got to go back and deal with that coal ash poison, at least give them the opportunity to sit at that table and speak their truth.
Amen.
And you get the last word. I want to thank you all for participating in this, and thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.